This is Fahamu Paku, and this is How I Create.
Welcome to This is How We Create, a show that digs deeper into the creative life of contemporary artists of color. Discover what feeds their creativity and how they've found or are finding their artistic voice. Through these intimate and candid conversations, you'll gain insights into the lives of creative professionals of color that are hard to find anywhere else. Welcome back to This is How We Create. My name is Martine Severin, your host. You know, some people wait to be chosen, hired, or validated, but others don't wait at all. They make their own path with determination. They use different tools than most other folks use, such as guerrilla marketing, to get noticed. Dr. Fahamu Paku is one of those people. Today on the show, you'll hear his inspiring journey from dreaming of working as an animator to becoming an award-winning artist. Dr. Paku studied painting at college and later secured a job as a graphic designer when he graduated. This job completely changed the course of his artistic career and practice. In our talk with Dr. Paku, he shares how hip-hop influences his work, and how his work came to challenge societal views of Black identity, and more specifically, Black masculinity. Now, here's a little bit more about Dr. Paku through his bio. Dr. Fahamu Paku received his BFA at the Atlanta College of Art and a PhD from Emory University. Dr. Paku exhibits his art worldwide in addition to lectures and speaking engagements at colleges and universities. As an educator, Dr. Paku has developed AdVantage Point, a narrative-based arts curriculum focused on Black male youth. Dr. Paku is also the founding director of the African Diaspora Art Museum of Atlanta, also known as ADAMA. Dr. Paku's work is featured in noted public and private national and international collections, including Smithsonian National Museum of African American Art and Culture and Société Générale in Paris, to name just a few. Dr. Paku was announced as one of the recipients of the 2022 Louis Comfort Tiffany Award. Just a heads up that there is adult language in this episode, so if you have sensitive ears or you have little kiddos around, just beware. You might want to pause this episode and come back to it when it's just you. Enjoy the show.
Welcome, Dr. Paku.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm so pleased to finally talk to you in person, because for the last few weeks since I knew you were going to come over, I've had the pleasure of stalking you all over the interweb. And so the first question I have for you is in regards to your schooling. You went to college and started out as a graphic designer. Can you tell me about how exactly you decided to choose graphic design as a major?
Sure thing. So actually, the twist is I never took a graphic design class in my life. I had zero idea or zero interest in graphic design to start out with. I actually started out in undergrad as an animation major. Growing up in South Carolina, you know, I was always like the kid who could draw, and I knew I wanted to be an artist, but I didn't know exactly what that meant or what that looked like. You know, I just liked to draw. And around the age of 9 or so, I learned about cartooning and cartoon animation as a career. And I had this set of encyclopedias from like 1969. And it said that a cartoonist could make up to $1,000 a week. And mind you, you know, as a little kid telling people you wanted to be an artist, people would say things like, oh, you're going to be a starving artist, or artists never make money until they die. And when I read this thing about cartoon animators making $1,000 a week, I was like, look, you know, here's a way I could make art. I could draw all day and I could make money. I don't have to be dead or starved to do it, right? And so I went into college fully committed to becoming an animator. And in fact, my dream at the time was to become the Black Walt Disney. You know, I had my own characters and stories. I used to make my own comic books, etc. So I was really, really committed to this idea of animation. But lo and behold, you know, at Atlanta College of Art, I got introduced to the fine arts, you know, which was a concept that I had never heard before. You know, growing up, I never went to galleries and museums, so I never actually saw paintings and sculptures and things like that. I knew they existed, but I'd never experienced it. And so that experience at Atlanta College of Art ended up being, you know, really eye-opening for me. You know, I got to meet young artists from around the world. And, you know, of course, I knew people who were in the graphic design program. And I used to hang out with a lot of them, you know, just playing around, doing silly stuff on the computer, messing with Photoshop, et cetera. But after I graduated from undergrad, I needed a job. You know, there's no job for, quote unquote, a painter, you know, which my degree was painting, because I changed from animation to painting shortly after coming to school. But yeah, I graduated with a degree in painting. I needed a job. So I lied on an application and said I knew how to do graphic design. But like I said, I'd never taken a graphic design class in my life. But that also ended up being a really great experience for me. It taught me a lot, and it actually prepared me to launch into my career. My work as a graphic designer actually set me up for the creative path that I ultimately went down.
Okay, so I think I better understand now. So you had your degree in painting. Mm-hmm. You lied to get a graphic design job and somehow became a graphic designer.
That's correct.
Can you tell me the story of what happens next? When you worked as a graphic designer, were you continuing along with painting? Were you pursuing that?
Yeah, most certainly. The entire time I was doing graphic design, I was really, you know, Clark Kenting it, you know what I mean? Like, by day, he's a mild-mannered graphic designer, but at night, he's slinging paint and trying to, you know, get his work into galleries. I ended up growing increasingly frustrated with the process. You know, everything that they told me to do in school, or that they taught me to do in school, I was doing. I was making my work. I was writing my artist statements. I was taking slides. I was sending packages to galleries, and no one was calling me back. And I, you know, was, like I said, was growing increasingly frustrated. And at the same time, I'm working side by side with like a who's who of late 90s hip hop artists in New York, you know, designing flyers and posters and album covers and, you know, all kinds of media for them. Getting a chance at being on the sort of like inside joke of marketing, you know, and that was really, really eye opening for me. I remember sitting with one of my clients at one point and thinking about the fact that, you know, they had this persona that was like this really tough hip hop guy. But in reality, in real life, they were one of the kindest, you know, nicest people you ever want to meet, you know, funny, charming, you know. And I just thought it was really interesting. Like, what if someone marketed a visual artist the way we market hip hop artists? You know, would people have the same reaction to them? Would people have the same response? And so I just kind of filed that away in the back of my head, continued to do my work as a graphic designer and continued to try to like send my stuff out to galleries. But ultimately, you know, my frustration led me to this concept that I call Fahamu Puku is the shit. And it really started out as a joke, but I started this guerrilla marketing campaign where I took that idea that I had earlier about marketing hip hop artists. And I was like, you know, I'm going to market myself as though I'm a hip hop artist to try to see if I can get the attention of galleries and, you know, others. And so I started this really like grassroots guerrilla marketing campaign. I had a friend take a photo of me with like no shirt on. And I did like this graphic illustration that sort of mimics the ad campaign around 50 Cent. Because at the time, 50 Cent was like the big, big thing. Everybody was on 50 Cent. And I always thought it was really interesting, you know, that, you know, by the time 50 Cent's album dropped, his first album dropped, everybody was already speaking his name because the marketing around him had been so, like, pervasive, right? And so I was like, I want to do something like that. You know, I created this campaign. It didn't say what I did. It didn't show you my artwork. It just was this graphic of me with the words, Fahamu Puku is the shit, paid for by the committee to make Fahamu Puku officially the shit. And it was really kind of like a joke. Like, I wanted to see what would happen. I really wanted to just kind of test my theory to see if it would work. And it was almost like instantaneous. You know, people were hitting me up and reacting to the posters and the stickers that I was wheat pasting all over the city of Atlanta. I started making T-shirts, you know, with the motto on it, with the graphic, and passing it out to friends. And they would come back, be like, you know, I had 5 or 6 people ask me where I got my shirt from today, you know. And, you know, it just was kind of like this experiment. But also, you know, like I said, it was a outcropping of my work as a graphic designer. I never thought about graphic design as art, but I ultimately realized that I could use this as a medium. Like, I can use graphic design as a medium and ultimately use that medium to inform my paintings. And so my paintings started to be influenced by my work as a graphic designer. You know, my early paintings were all based on magazine covers. Ended up being a really, like, enriching experience overall.
I have a secret respect for graphic designers. I find that they tend to see the world in a way that is beneficial to whatever it is that they end up doing. Mm-hmm. So much so that when my family and I, when we lived in London, I took classes at Central St. Martin's in graphic design because I knew that that way of seeing things would really help in being able to enhance anything that I would do as an artist in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But you've just dropped so much, given us so many great gold nuggets, and I just don't know where to go in terms of the next question. I guess I am very curious. Can you tell us about some of the hip hop artists you worked with back in the day?
Yeah, for sure. So one of the first projects that I ever did at the boutique agency I worked at in New York, maybe like a week before I started, Puff Daddy just opened Justin's restaurant, which was on the next block behind us. So one of my first jobs was to design some of the menus and, you know, flyers and stuff like that for Justin's restaurant. So I got to work with Puff and his team on those kind of materials. Here in Atlanta, you know, I did the very first album cover for Young Jeezy. I did a number of projects with a hip hop label here in Atlanta called Big Oomph Records. For years, I designed all of their collateral and materials. You know, I did the design posters and flyers for a hip hop compilation in New York called Sound Bombing. So it was a really real, like, sort of gamut of, like, hip hop, from like the mainstream artists to underground artists. You know, I work with brands like, you know, the Atlanta Hawks and Coca-Cola, and, you know, ultimately had an opportunity to work with, you know, politicians like Shirley Franklin, who became the first mayor of Atlanta, a first female mayor of Atlanta. So, yeah, I worked with a lot of different people and on a lot of different cool projects.
One of the things that I notice is how people who want to be an artist versus those who talk about being an artist, those who really want to and actually execute on ensuring and doing things and have tactics that really tips everything in their favor, they do that through action.
Mm-hmm.
And I can only imagine the gumption to create an ad and to go around Atlanta and printing and papering walls with your name and having a tagline that says paid for by the committee. I mean, can you tell me a little bit about, like, that work? Because I'm really interested, because, and I think, like, to win as an artist, there are all of these little things that you have to do, and they all build up to mm-hmm. ensure your success. If you could share some of the nitty gritty details of what it actually took to do that campaign. I'm just very curious.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you asked me that, because the thing about it was it wasn't a very thought out thing. Like, I was really just sort of experimenting. I was just having fun. You know, the idea, you know, the impetus for it was my frustration with, you know, not being able to get any kind of response or feedback from the packages that I was sending out to galleries, right? And ultimately deciding that I didn't want to wait for, you know, someone to validate me as an artist, that I could, essentially take the reins into my own hands, right? Using, you know, marketing, using my skills as a graphic designer to kind of aid me along in that endeavor. One of the first things that really caught my attention, as I mentioned before, was the marketing campaign around 50 Cent, right? And so what I didn't mention before is, you know, while I didn't have any experience or training as a graphic designer, I self-taught, you know, by studying magazines. So when I first got that job working as a graphic designer, I would go to, like, you know, Tower Records and bookstores and buy, like, all the hip magazines, and typically they were music magazines. And so I would just kind of go through and, like, study the design and the composition and, you know, colors and layouts and stuff like that. And I would, you know, try to create my own versions of those types of designs, highly inspired by a lot of the design aesthetic of, like, the UK in the, like, late 90s, early 2000s, right? Like, that was a really, really big inspiration for me. But, you know, once I came up with that concept, you know, again, kind of patterning it off of the 50 Cent campaign, I just had a bunch of, like, you know, really crazy friends who were down to support me. I had worked already for many years as a promoter, you know, so when I wasn't doing graphic design and when I wasn't doing painting in my studio, you know, I promoted and hosted an open mic, a spoken word open mic night. So, you know, I was always out passing out flyers and, you know, doing all that kind of stuff. So I was, like, in that world already, in that kind of, like, guerrilla marketing, street team world. I was doing that kind of stuff already. And so it was a really sort of seamless transition to, you know, bring this campaign to bear. I knew all the spots that I could hit. I knew where to go to Kinko's and which Kinko's to go to at 2 a.m., you know, to get the posters printed for cheap, you know what I mean, so that I could go and we paste. You know, around that same time, Black Planet and MySpace were starting to take shape, you know, and I started what I consider the first social media marketing campaign, particularly on Black Planet, because you could create as many accounts as you want on Black Planet. And so I would make fictitious accounts where I would, you know, promote, oh, man, did you see that Fahamu Puku, you know, thing, and, like, pass it along and, like, try to get it, you know, like, get people to, like, respond and react to things I was posting online. One of the things that I used to do as a part of the campaign was find, like, pictures of people that were super whack, right? And I would do, like, a compare and contrast. So I'd do, like, the whack photo of somebody and it would say, not the shit. And then it would be my image, you know, and it would say Fahamu Puku is the shit, accept no imitations, paid for by the committee, you know. So I was doing all kinds of, like, you know, experimental things like that, just, again, just to kind of see if I could get a reaction, just to see what the response would be. And I didn't have a goal in mind. I just was doing it and just wanting to make sure that this was the thing that was kind of like my driving motivation. I was like, well, you know, maybe the galleries aren't calling me back because they can't pronounce my name. So I'm going to put it out there as much as possible. So it's so saturated, you know, that when they see something come across their desk, they'll say, oh, I've seen this name before. This is that guy. Let me take a look at it. Right. And so that was really my sort of goal with the street campaign, but it just evolved into so much more.
That's so interesting because it's so true when people say, start with where you are, because in this case, you had experience in marketing, in guerrilla marketing, and you just use that to your advantage. Mm-hmm. And I reckon that might be really great for someone else. I mean, not the specific, you know, guerrilla marketing, but when you have an expertise elsewhere, you can really tailor it towards what you want to do. So that's really great. So tell me about some of the results from that. Did people start calling you and knocking down your door? Or was it just like, or was it just you just got a few bits of interest from that campaign?
And I got a lot of interest. It ended up being, like, national and international, even long before, you know, I left Atlanta, long before I set foot out of Atlanta to do anything. People became familiar with the brand. You know, I had friends who lived in other cities who, again, like, would wear the shirts, and then people would be interested, and then they would go and look it up. And, you know, everybody thought that the catchphrase, you know, is the shit, was like a, you know, really catchy and fun and provocative thing, you know, so it just caught people's attention. Maybe around 2002, because I started this campaign in 2000. So around 2002, you know, still doing my thing, you know, researching and studying magazines. I got a subscription card in one of the magazines that I found, and it had an image of a, you know, a person on the cover of this forthcoming issue that I didn't recognize. And it sparked another question in my head. It was like, you know, when you see somebody on the cover of a magazine, you automatically think they're somebody important. They're on the cover of a magazine, even if you've never heard of them before. So I was like, I should be on the cover of a magazine. And so I made up a magazine called Contemporaneo, and I designed a subscription card, you know, for this fake magazine. And it said, if you fill it out and you mail it back in, you'll get a free issue of Contemporaneo featuring Fahamu Puku. And then I went back to bookstores all over the city, and I just put these cards that I made in all the magazines, because I wanted to see, again, what would happen if people would think it was real, if people would actually react to it. And these cards came back by the hundreds, like people, you know, mailing them in, you know, requesting this issue of this fake magazine that doesn't exist. And, it, you know, it just really like began to demonstrate to me the effectiveness, the power of marketing, right? The power of media to direct and oftentimes to instill, you know, our sense of value and culture and society. Like, you know, we often think of those things as being something that comes from inside of us. But no, that stuff is informed and influenced by things that go on outside of us. And we take the parts that resonate with us the most. Right. And I just found that to be a really interesting. And, you know, later on down the line, as I started getting more into like my academic work and stuff like that, and understanding psychology and the great deal of psychology that's embedded in marketing and advertising and media, it just really let me understand even deeper the impact of this kind of expression.
Mm. Yeah, such great ideas. So you say that you were very much influenced by the movie Menace to Society, and it went on. And I think from what I remember, you said that influenced you even before you went to college. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to me about that story and how that influences what you do even to today?
Mm-hmm. Menace came out the summer that I graduated high school, right? So right between me graduating high school and me leaving to go to college. Like everybody my age, you know, at that time, it was the movie that you wanted to go see, you know, like it was the movie for the hip hop generation of that summer. So I was super excited to see it. But what I was unprepared for was the visceral reaction that I had to watching the film. I literally walked out of the theater that day thinking, I'm going to die. And it wasn't, I realized, you know, more now, you know, as an adult, that it wasn't just that film did that to me, but it was the compiling of images of Black male bodies in various states of destruction, right? The imposition of Black male bodies dying, right? Like violence of gangs, you know, drive-by shootings. I have friends in high school who, you know, were killed because of getting jumped in a fight or, you know, being shot over a girl, you know, like things like that. Witnessing this stuff real time, but I'm also, you know, coming out of growing up in an environment where you're constantly being told that as a Black man, your options are very limited, that you're more likely to end up in prison than in college, and that, you know, you're more likely to, you know, have a child out of wedlock that forces you into, you know, some sort of labor or job that it's not really your dream or passion, but you just got to pay the bills at this point, right? You know, so it's like all of these layers of death-bound subjectivity that I'm that I've grown up in and around, and Menace was just sort of like the straw that broke the camel's back. It was interesting on a number of levels for me because there were a lot of parallels between, parallels I saw between the main character Kane and myself in terms of him having lost both of his parents violently at an early age, being raised by older relatives in the projects, you know, like that was my story as well. You know, the difference was I wasn't into any kind of gang activity or any, you know, like I wasn't that kind of kid, you know what I mean? But just the idea that Kane was preparing to leave LA and start a new life in Atlanta, and I was preparing to leave this town, these projects, and move to Atlanta, you know what I mean? To watch him die, you know, it just made me feel like, wow, what's the point? Like, I'm going to die anyway, you know what I mean? Like, there's no real reason to try at this stage, you know? And so I kind of carried that sentiment with me unconsciously for a number of years after. Like, I would mark accomplishments or, you know, mark my birthdays by celebrating things that the tragedies I avoided, right? So 19, I ain't been shot yet. 20, I ain't never been arrested. You know what I mean? And I like literally went through that almost every year until I was about 28 years old, just anticipating my demise, right? Like all of the negative language, the negative media, the negative portrayals or the absence or exclusion of options of for my black male body made me anticipate my demise. And so ultimately, you know, that's where my work lives today. You know, I'm trying to counter the images and the pervasive narrative of black male destruction, you know, from external as well as internal forces. You know, I'm trying to complicate images of black masculinity by depicting us, you know, in a number of infinite number of ways, right? That we can be so many things that, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day about the fact that when I was maybe 8 or 9 years old, I remember having a thought, certainly like, or perhaps maybe even depressed at my lot in life, right? As a little boy, but thinking just because it is this way doesn't mean it has to be this way, right? Like just because something is doesn't mean it has to be. And, you know, trying to inject that same sentiment through my work by showing us again in as many ways as possible, by confronting the stereotypes and literally in some cases getting inside of them as a way of exploding them inside out, by celebrating the aspects of our existence, our performance, our comportment that is often highly criticized, like, you know, sagging pants and stuff like that. People just write off young men who are doing that. But it's like, you know, you need that space of rebellion. You need that space of edge to kind of begin to define yourself against, you know, what society tells you you are, right? You know, so there's all of these different really like complex ideas about black masculinity that I'm attempting to engage that allows us as black men, but also those of us who are not black men, to see ourselves more broadly and more humanely.
Thank you. I think all of that and the work that you've been doing, it certainly comes through to your work. I know that you did. I remember hearing about your installation, You Can't Cop Cars. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that relates to your practice of redefining what black masculinity looks like?
Yeah, for sure. You know, again, I think there's so much emphasis on black subjectivity in various states of trauma that I wanted to, you know, my interest in my work more and more lately has been an attempt to sort of distance ourselves or what's the word I'm looking for? Disassociate from the ideas of blackness that are tied to white supremacy, right? So rather than thinking about, you know, the trials and things that we have to go through through the lens of trauma, I try to seek the beauty in it. Like, what are the moments worth preserving, right, in these spaces? And so We Can't Cop Cars Without Seeing Cop Cars came out of this idea of mobility and agency in Black male youth culture. For many young Black men, your first taste of like true freedom and liberation is when you get that car, when you get that whip, and you can, you know, start to move around and go where you want to go. And, you know, I've always been really intrigued and also moved by the irony of the fact that, you know, a lot of times, especially here in the South, when, you know, young men get their first car, they, you know, they don't go to a lot or a dealership. They go to an auction, you know, or they go to somebody, you know, around the way. And you might find like decommissioned police cruisers, you know. And so you see these young men driving, like you're driving down the street and you look in your rearview mirror, you see the silhouette of a police car, and then it passes you. And it's just like some young dudes, you know, joyriding, you know. And I always thought that was really ironic that the, you know, a popular vehicle amongst young Black men is this, you know, particular silhouette, this Crown Victoria police cruiser, you know what I mean? Like, that has symbolized so much trauma, but gets transformed into something, you know, that gives you like freedom, like something that once represented, you know, your detention, that once represented your restraint, now becomes a thing that gives you wings, right? And so We Can't Cop Cars is about giving, it's a film and installation where you see a young man fantasizing, daydreaming about being able to be in a car just riding freely, but reality brings you back and you see that he's really, you know, just laying in a junkyard, you know, daydreaming about the day that he can have that kind of mobility, that kind of freedom. The title of the piece comes from a lyric by Kanye West. It says, "We can't cop cars without seeing cop cars." And so it's really, you know, about that irony of, you know, agency and mobility, and, you know, the ways we sometimes restrict our own vision of what we can be and what we can do.
I feel like we could have spent the whole conversation just on that installation and talking about it more deeply, but there's time is one of those things. I'd love to wrap up our conversation by asking you this one question. Mm-hmm. I know that Hebrew Brentley mentions that you have made a profound influence on his life, and I'd love for you to think about who in your life has made a profound influence in terms of being a mentor or a benefactor of you, your creative work, and your intellectual well-being.
Yeah. Man, it's a laundry list of folks. but I'll start out by saying, one, you know, have to reflect that same sentiment and energy about my brother. Like, Hebrew has been a huge inspiration to me. We used to share a studio in Atlanta back in the day. He's one of my best friends. And, you know, we always used to kind of collaborate and work on pieces together. But I always credit Hebrew with demonstrating for me the beauty of, like, really demonstrating for me the beauty of painting, right? Like, while I studied painting, like, I understood it more in terms of, like, you know, the formal aspects of it. I was very, you know, almost scientific, you know, in my approach to painting. But spending time watching Hebrew paint and watching his courage, watching his freedom, like, you know, he is the kind of artist, you know, he'll start out with something and then by the end of the day it's something completely different. Like, he just keeps working into it until it becomes what, you know, what he wants it to be, right? And I always thought that was really, really beautiful. Like, it was a really mesmerizing thing to watch. You know, I think sometimes as artists, we are afraid to relinquish control, and Hebrew is the exact opposite. And I always appreciated that about him. Also got to give a big shout out to my mentor, Dr. Arturo Lindsay. He was my first painting professor. But he was also the first artist that I ever met who actually was in real time living the idea of what an artist can be that I had in my mind, you know? Like, he was the first person that I could, like, literally reach out and touch that was an artist, you know, that was accomplished. Like, you go to his house and he's listening to jazz music and he's traveled the world and he's written books and he's a professor, you know, and just, you know, really genuine spirit. There was also the connection we had in that Arturo is from Panama, from the same place that my father was born in Panama. They both immigrated to the United States around the same age, you know, so we shared that connection as well. But yeah, Arturo continues to be my great mentor to this day. He's like become like a dad to me. And like everything that I have become has really been from walking in Arturo's footsteps, including, you know, my pursuit of the PhD. I never heard of that before I met Arturo. You know, he modeled for me the kind of life and career that I aspired to. And then finally, I have to give a shout out to Karen Marie Mason. Karen unfortunately passed away last year, but for, you know, 20 plus years before that, Karen was my business manager, confidant, my coach. She guided me in terms of the business side. She always, even when I was doing Fahamupuku's the shit and I was, you know, it was a joke to me. You know, she was always very much like, you know, what you're doing is, you know, like she would put it into a context that allowed me to see that there was more to that story than the jokey part of it, right? Like there was something serious and compelling in the stories that I was attempting to tell. And so I always appreciated that about her. But, you know, even more than that, just the way that she loved on and continues to love on me and propel me forward, because I can be somewhat shy and reserved. And she would always pull me out and say, yo, Paku, big up yourself. And so, you know, we try to do that all the time.
Thank you so much. I mean, this, thank you for being so generous with your time and for dropping so much knowledge. I know that I've walked away with some really great ways in terms of rethinking what I do, and I'm hoping that the listeners have found the same. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Dr. Paku. It's my pleasure.